This is the fifth day of this July 2008 seven-day session. And we'll take one more day on our text. We've been using up to now the collected works of Chinul, the 12th century Korean Zen master Chinul. Question. Once delusion is brought to rest, as explained previously, the true mind will appear. But as long as delusion has not been extinguished, should we use only the no-mind practice to bring delusion to rest, or are there other methods to counteract delusion? The no-mind practice would be the practices that we're doing here, breath, koan, shikantaza. Questioning. Chinul, the primary practice and secondary aids are not the same. To extinguish delusion with no mind is the primary practice. To train in all wholesome actions is the secondary aid. It's like a bright mirror which is covered with dust. Even though we rub it with the hand, we still need a good polish to make it lustrous. Then and only then will its brightness manifest. The dust is defilement. The force of the polishing hand is the practice of no mind. The polish is all the wholesome actions. The shine of the mirror is the true mind. And then he quotes the Awakening of Faith, one of the great Mahayana texts, by Shantideva, I think. And this is what Shantideva says. Furthermore, faith accomplishes the activation of bodhicitta, the aspiration to enlightenment. What mind does it activate? Briefly, there are three kinds. The first is the straight mind, which is right attention to the Dharma of true suchness. The second is the deep mind, which accumulates all wholesome practices. The third is the mind of great compassion, which aims to eradicate the sufferings of all sentient beings. And then here, still in this passage by Shantideva, question, you have explained the one sign of the Dharma Dhatu and the non-duality of the Buddha essence. Why do we not simply recollect true suchness instead of contriving to train in all wholesome practices? So, why don't we simply do one of these breath or koan practices instead of these secondary practices? The secondary practices, there include so many, but they also include ceremonies, rituals, bowing, chanting, devotions of all kinds. And then the answer, the mind, this is still Shantideva, the mind is like a large gem. Its essential nature is luminous and transparent, but it is tainted by impurities of the ore. If a person merely imagines the essence of this gem, but does not polish it in various ways with expedience meaning these secondary practices, it will never become transparent. In the same way, the essential nature of the Dharma of true suchness, which is inherent in sentient beings, is void and clear, but it is stained by incalculable defilements and impurities. If the person only imagines that true suchness, but fails to develop his mind in various ways by training in expedience, it too will never get clean. As the impurities are incalculable and pervade all things, he cultivates all wholesome practices in order to counteract them. The these wholesome secondary practices would also include training in the precepts and upholding the precepts. And then Chinu just concludes, according to this explanation, bringing the deluded mind to rest is the primary practice, and cultivating all wholesome dharmas is the secondary aid. Even some people who come to Sesshin, I suspect, still have reservations about the some of the rituals and chanting, the bowing, prostrations, and so forth, the meal chants. I just assume that because not everyone has the same affinity with devotions, devotional practices. I myself had resistance in my early days of practice, resistance to chanting and so forth. But this is where you got to give some credit to this great tradition of many, many centuries of proven value. These great masters who saw through form, they saw the formless nature of form. In other words, they saw through all rituals and practices of all kinds, saw through the precepts themselves. If they preserved these things, if they included these things and did these things themselves, then it's for good reason. It enriches the practice, these secondary practices. It enriches it and gives soul to what would otherwise could be a very dry practice of just the meditation itself. There are many stories of some of the greatest of the Chinese masters, Zen masters, and in Japan, who maintained these kinds of practices with great fervor and faith. And then, if one can get on board with them and do them with a believing mind, then the doing of them will reveal their value. Just doing them long enough to get over the resistance to doing them, just doing them long enough, one will experience the richness of this part of Zen practice. With chanting, I think I read somewhere, I'm not sure, but that chanting, like singing, opens up the right side of the brain and puts us in touch with that which is beyond the linear, the rational, the logical. So while chanting, we're in a different part of our brain is probably lit up than at other times. And this anytime we can get away from the ordinary executive functions of the brain, the linear, the rational, the discriminating, then we are bringing balance to the mind and opening the mind to new vistas. know this because we can get into a chanting samadhi. If we're purely concentrated on the chanting, especially if we don't have to be reading a book, when we read from the chant book, then we've got that left brain going again. But if we can just once we've memorized the chant, then we have them in our body, and then we can chant them. It's almost like we're not even particularly aware of the words, and then if we can just thoroughly immerse ourselves in the chanting, without thoughts of others who are around us, without thoughts about the chanting, but just doing the chanting itself. With our full being, with our full body, doing the chanting beyond thought, then we can reach this state of profound absorption that we call samadhi. Question: when the true mind appears, how do we know that it has matured without obstructions? Chinu: although the true mind might manifest to those who are training, if they have not yet eliminated their habit energies, they will occasionally lose their mindfulness when they encounter matured objects. It is like a herdsman who has trained his ox to follow obediently, but still would not dare to lay down his whip or tether. He must wait until the ox's mind is fully trained and its pace steady, so that even if he guided it through a field of tender young rice sprouts, it would not harm the paddy. Only then would he dare to loosen his grip. At that stage, even though he does not use the whip or tether, the ox would not injure the young sprouts. It is the same for the one on the path. Even after he has realized the true mind, he has to strive to maintain and nurture that realization in order to obtain great power and function. Then and only then will he be able to benefit sentient beings. That's the key part. Always remember, the key thing in all this is getting ourselves into such a state of development and purity of mind that we will be able to benefit sentient beings. People, if they're honest, may admit that they really don't think that much about benefiting sentient beings. They're just trying to get through their koan, or try to assuage some of the pain and confusion they have. And that is just what it is. It means one hasn't ripened to the point yet where that other aspiration of doing this to be of service to others has come forth. But it's there. It will. If one continues long enough, then it grows, this sense of the real purpose of all this, which is to become vessels of compassion, giving to others. This phrase, in order to obtain great power and function. Function is such a dry word, but what it means is that it's one thing to have seen into our true nature through what is usually quite a faint opening of awakening. That's one thing, but then to have it function in our lives is an altogether different thing and a much more difficult thing. So to have seen through this illusory self, to have seen into the oneness of all beings, that's one thing, but because of these, what he calls habit energies, our ability to respond out of that usually lags behind. That's where this training that he's talking about is so important, that the deepening of one's understanding through ongoing practice, throughout one's life practice, is so important. What is the choice? To live a life without practice, a life that is not lit with practice, void through practice? People whose practice is immature may find the thought that oh my God, I have to do this my whole life. I remember thinking that. But one, if we can just keep plugging away at it, then that odd perspective, we outgrow it, and we see that it is such a privilege to do this practice. It's sort of like doing regular exercise, workouts of one kind or another. From time to time, when I've had an injury where I couldn't work out, couldn't get exercise, it's occurred to me that the worst thing, the only thing worse than having to work out is not being able to. It's the same with practice for people who resist it, who find it a chore, something to fit in their day, competing with everything else. See how you manage your relationship. See how you get through your day, and how the nature, the quality of your work and your family life, and without sitting. But of course, people do drift away from practice. It happens all the time. Even people who have been to many sesshins, their lives get so clogged with demands, and they just, for one reason or another, they find that they can't get to this. They were hoping to get to this sesshin, but no, they can't make it. They can't apply after all because this thing is coming up, this deadline or family obligation, and the next one, then I'll get to the next session for sure. And then something comes up there, things, work gets terribly busy, and okay, then maybe in the winter, definitely get to one then. But then you're on this spiral where, especially if you're not sitting every day, you start to lose touch with how sitting affects us, how it benefits us. And then little by little, one either stops sitting altogether, or stops coming to Sesshin. And then you forget. It fades. You forget how practice can give our lives something more. Question: when the true mind and the deluded mind are involved with the sense spheres, how can we distinguish the true from the deluded? Chinu: when the deluded mind is in contact with the sense spheres, it knows through discriminative awareness. It gives rise to greedy or hateful states of mind, depending on whether pleasant or unpleasant objects are present. So things that we like and things we don't like. Things we want to hear or see or taste or smell or touch or think about, and things we don't want to. Or else it gives rise to ignorant states of mind when neutral objects are encountered. Since the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion are produced because of these objects, it is easy to see that the mind is deluded. A patriarch said, "The conflict between the adverse and the favorable, this is the sickness of the mind." This is probably another translation of one of the two of the lines from our Affirming Faith in Mind. Basically, it's disease of liking and disliking. Not just liking and disliking, but being attached to our likes and dislikes. It's perfectly normal to like some things and dislike other things, but it's when we feel we have a right to avoid the things we don't like and the right to have what we like, that's when we get into trouble. We just cause ourselves misery. Consequently, he says, we know that it is the deluded mind which sustains the dichotomy between right and wrong. As far as the true mind is concerned, it knows while knowing nothing. It knows while knowing nothing. What kind of knowing is that? I think of this old saying in Zen. It's like one who, when drinking water, knows for herself whether it is cold or warm. It's not discriminative knowledge. It's experience. You wouldn't need to have language to know whether it's cold or warm. Only to use those words. As far as the true mind is concerned, it knows while knowing nothing. But because it is impartial, quiet, and utterly radiant, it is different from the nescience of grass and trees. I had to look up this word, not for the first time. Nescience means not knowing. It's not knowing, lack of awareness or knowledge. So it's different from the not knowing of grass and trees. Since it does not give rise to feelings of hatred or lust, it is different from the deluded mind. The mind which, when in contact with the sense spheres, is empty and yet bright, neither hateful nor lustful, not knowing and yet aware, this indeed is the true mind. Not knowing and yet aware. Aware. Therefore, he says, that not knowing, which is precisely awareness, cannot be said to be different from the sage's mind. Question, I'm just going to whittle this down to the gist of it. Why is it that most people who practice Zen are unable to display the wisdom of spiritual powers? I laughed and said, the wisdom of spiritual powers depends upon the power of Dharma, which derives from right faith in the Buddha mind. It is obtained by energetically applying oneself to amplified practice, energetically applying oneself. It is like polishing a mirror. The more you wipe the dust away, the brighter it becomes. Finally, once the brightness is clear, images reflect in thousands of details. But if one's faith and understanding are incorrect, and one's efforts flag, or if one sits dozing in dullness and assumes that maintaining silence is Zen, how can spiritual powers possibly manifest? An ancient worthy once said, if you simply practice properly in regard to your own nature, you need not be concerned about the three knowledges and six spiritual powers. And why? Because they are only secondary concerns of the sages. And then Chino continues, the main concern now is to understand the mind and dig to the root. If you can get to the root, you need not worry about the branches. So it's a different approach, in a very basic way. It's different from the psychological approach, where it's more analytical, where you get into examining habits and reactions with the help of someone trained in psychotherapy. Here, that for all of the benefit that I know, that I'm convinced is in that, In Zen, it's that would still be considered the branches, the leaves and the branches. Not that leaves and branches should be ignored. They're also part of the tree. But in Zen, our specialty is going to the root, not involving ourselves with the psychological, but going beneath it, beyond it, to this issue of the self itself. The most, I think this is not unfair, the most that psychological practices can bring us is to a state of integration where we're not always tripping over this self. We're not fighting ourselves because of complexes that are getting in the way, and we're not divided in our self, but we're able to live with and hold the different aspects of our emotional nature. But for seeing through the self, as integrated as it may be, seeing through it entirely, this is the province of Zen. To see that fundamentally there is no discrete, fixed self. There's no little man in here. There's no little woman in there. It is a what we call this self is a constellation. It is rather like a constellation. You know, we look up in the sky, we see a certain pattern of stars, and we come up with a name, the Big Dipper. But it doesn't mean that pattern has any substance to it. It's just an arbitrary thing because there's a continuity. Those stars, those few stars, stay in that configuration. They have for a very long time and probably will for much longer, but not forever. Or it's like a rainbow. We look at a rainbow and we call it, we give a name, have a name for it. It's a rainbow. But we know there's nothing really there of much substance, some moisture, reflecting light, but you pass our hand right through it. In the same way, what we call this self is just this cluster of thoughts, memories, associations, images. It's all nothing of substance. But then we come to believe in it as something fixed. Every time we think in terms of the I, the me, or the my, we are reinforcing that constellation, that rainbow that really has no substance to it. It does have some continuity to it. It has congealed to an extent that we have much the same personality characteristics, character structure from day to day, year after year, but that's just a kind of relative continuity to it. It's not absolute. It's nothing fixed, nothing permanent. He continues, if you do not stabilize yourself in the quietness of Zazen, your activating consciousness will drift about without a foundation. When you are near death, wind and fire will oppress you. When the four elements separate and scatter, meaning the death of the physical body, the mind will go wild, burning with sadness, and become subject to inverted thinking and distorted views. As you have no possibility of soaring into the heavens above, nor any stratagem for entering the earth below, you will cower in fright, bereft of all you used to rely on. Your body will be left behind to decay as if it were the slough of a cicada. Confused about the way which stretches far into the distance, he's talking here about the bardo, it's the period immediately following death. Confused about the way which stretches far into the distance, your solitary spirit will have to go on alone. Although you have gems, wealth, and priceless jewelry, you cannot carry any of it away with you. Although you may be from an aristocratic household and have many relatives, not one of them can follow behind and look after you. This is what is meant by what one makes for oneself, one receives for oneself. There is no one who can take your place. At that time, what discernment do you have to bridge the sea of suffering? Chino says, do not say that because you have a small portion of merit, you will be able to avoid this calamity. And then he quotes Master Po Chan. Even though you have merit, perspicacity, and vast learning, none of it will be able to save you. As your mind's eye has not yet opened, you will have only conditioned thoughts which are involved in the sense spheres. You do not yet know how to look back on the radiance of the mind. Furthermore, as you have not yet seen the path to Buddhahood, at the time of death, all of your life's unwholesome actions appear before you, either alarming you or making you joyful. The six destinies and the five aggregates appear before you, the six realms of unenlightened existence, the five skandhas. You see beautifully decorated houses, boats, carts, and palanquins all shining brilliantly in the light of the self nature. These sights make your mind dissolute so that the things you view with greed and lust are all transformed into pleasing objects. At the place where these things are most intense, you are reborn without one iota of choice in the matter. Whether as a dragon or an ox, whether of high or low status, nothing is certain. This first line, even though you have merit, perspicacity, and vast learning, none of it will be able to save you. I think of a movie that I saw a year or two ago with Emma Thompson called Wit. Wit in the sense of intelligence, or IQ, let's say. It tells in a very moving and dramatic way of the story of a brilliant English professor who suddenly hears diagnosis of terminal cancer. It shows what a torment she goes through in as she realizes that all of her intelligence, all of her learning is for naught. It sounds depressing, but it's really, for someone on the path, it's a real clear-eyed look at things as they are, the fact of impermanence, and what Chinuo, or rather this Po Chang, is talking about here. I suppose some people would take this to be morbid. I don't see it that way. It's reality. It's what is coming sooner or later. Would it be better to deny it, to block it out, to ignore it until we get on our deathbed? Of course not. We have so much we can do now to train in this matter of dying, which is no different from living. What we learn, what we acquire through our experience in practice, and most dramatically in Sesshin, this is not just practice in dying, it's practice in living. We come to understand how to conduct ourselves, how in our lives, so that they become enhanced, they become fuller, so we really are living our lives, not just existing. He continues, therefore, those with superior understanding and enduring will should first consider deeply the incontrovertible relation between action and result throughout the three time periods, past, present, and future. There is no place to which you may escape. If the conditions you create now are in error and your practice cannot advance, later you will have to receive the suffering due. This would certainly be miserable. Hence, in the first, middle, and last parts of the night, quietly forget all conditioning. Sit tall and straight. Do not cling to external signs. Concentrate the mind and reflect internally. Clarify the mind. Let it be expansive and unobscured, free of thoughts, but aware. Be entirely unreceptive to visions or experiences which do not tally with what you have learned in the Buddhist teachings. So, in other words, makyo or other peripheral experiences, don't cling to them. If there are worldly affairs to be dealt with, determine exactly what should and should not be done. None of the manifold supplementary practices of the Bodhisattva should be rejected. This is what we were talking about earlier. Even if there are things which need attention, do not neglect the mind's empty brightness and abide constantly in quietude. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.